Clear to order and open a work session on House Bill 4085.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4085 had a public hearing on Monday the 3rd. You'll recall this modifies the current requirements for insurance coverage of colorectal cancer screening examination and lab tests relating to the removal of polyps during a colonoscopy. It applies to policies or certificates issued or renewed on or after the effective date of the act. It has an emergency clause. We now have a fiscal impact statement, which is a no fiscal impact, and there's no revenue. So if the committee so chooses and there are no amendments, the bill is before the committee.
And I heard no opposition to the bill. It does not relate to the lab test. It only relates to the colonoscopy in its own right.
Yes.
Yes.
And do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4085 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
President Thompson moves House Bill 4085 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on House Bill 4085?
It's a great bill.
Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Representative Wigley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
4085.
She knows I like it when she mixes it up a little bit.
Aye.
Good job.
Representative Pence?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenway?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Tomei will carry it, please. Can we close the work session on 4085? Open a work session on House Bill 4108. Madam Administrator, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4108 requires the Oregon Health Authority to contract with community-based organizations to operate pilot projects that would provide used durable medical equipment to medical assistant recipients. This also appropriates money for that project to the Health Authority. We do have a fiscal... We heard the bill on Monday the 3rd. At that time, the committee adopted the -1 and the -3... -2 amendments to the bill, so those have received committee action. We now have a fiscal and revenue on both of those amendments, and indeed we do have a revenue on the -2 showing the increase of allocation of $75,000 from the $50,000 in the original bill, and this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Committee does not need to adopt the amendments again, just take action on the bill as amended.
Do we have a motion?
Chair, I move House Bill 4108 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves that we pass House Bill 4108 with a due pass recommendation to the floor of the House and with a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by as amended by to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on this bill?
Okay. I just want to thank Elders in Action and Council on People with Disabilities, a whole variety of groups that played a really strong role in helping shape this.
And the amendment, the second, the -2 amendment, brings Umatilla County into the bill. Any other discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Representative Wigley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conker?
Excused.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenwood?
Aye. Motion carries. 4185. 4108 is off the Ways and Means. I sent Representative Jensen off on the assumption that it would take a little longer to do that. So instead, let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 4070.
Debbie. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4070 requires the Board of Dentistry, upon the request of an individual who has been disciplined by the board, to remove from its website and other publicly accessible print and electronic publications information relating to the disciplining of the individual if the individual has met certain criteria. This declares an emergency as effective on passage. This is a public hearing only, so, but we don't have a fiscal.
Do we have a representative here?
We do not.
Cameron? No? Okay.
Who do we got?
Georgia Coolidge.
We have Patrick Box and Georgia Coolidge. If you guys, thank you. Mr. Box, you're welcome to say anything you want, but you're here for reference in case anybody needs it.
Basically,
as well.
Yep.
George, you're going to kick it off?
So what was that? Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George O'Kulich, here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association, here in support of House Bill 4070. As you may recall, this was sort of a continuation of a piece of legislation that Representative Gilliam introduced last session, and towards the end of that session, he asked us to continue to have some conversations around expungement of dental records, which we have sort of continued to do so, and the bill in front of you, House Bill 4070, reflects some of those conversations. Right now, if someone in the general public wants to look up their dentist, and they put it in, if there is a disciplinary action, there's sort of big, bright, red letters that say, this dentist has been disciplined, and then you have to sort of click through it to find the consent order and sort of what the action has been sort of taken. I'd be happy to stop and...
No, please.
To sort of find out what sort of disciplinary action has been taken against a licensee. There was some concern from some of our members that there is really no distinction between somebody who has done something significant, like physically harming a patient, pulling the wrong tooth, and someone that has maybe done something minor, improper, record keeping, or something that had no intention of, didn't harm a patient. And so what we tried to do in this bill is say, let's exclude sort of the more, the egregious cases where a patient has been harmed both physically or financially, and allow a process where somebody who, I think the bill says 10 years, we've talked about it, maybe down to 5 years, has basically shown for the last 5 years that they have had no disciplinary action and they've been in good standing with the board. Sort of the intention is that, again, it wouldn't be an automatic thing. It would just allow a process by which the licensee could come back to the Board of Dentistry and say, the issue that I was disciplined for didn't harm a patient. It was more of a personal issue. It's been 5 or 10 years since I was disciplined. Since then, I've been in good standing. And then at that point, the board could take a look at the action, make a judgment call, and then decide to pull off to expunge that record.
Is it only pulling off the website, or is it taking it out of other records?
So the bill says moves from its website and publicly accessible publications. So I know we've had some conversations with Mr. Bratz in the past about some of his concerns around expungement with some of the federal data keeping, and he'd be better suited to sort of talk about that. I think from my members' perspective, the biggest thing is that website is sort of to say, somebody can't really tell or has to really dig deep to try to find out what their action is. And so for those cases, have it a little clearer, that it wasn't sort of an egregious offense.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Shall I get a microphone?
Nope.
Definitely want to hear you, sir.
Pardon me?
Speak for yourself.
Vic Gilliam, you liked that better, didn't you? Vic Gilliam, State Representative from Silverton. Thank you for hearing this bill. We all bring our experiences to this building, and we can't make it our own personal legislature to pass bills just because we heard a story or we have a friend. But I did hear a compelling story, and I'm not going to go into great detail or identify the person, but it's the impetus for me to bring this forward. This dentist is about to retire, and her motivation is mainly for those behind her in her profession. And she had one error in her judgment and in her past. It did not harm a patient. She immediately self-reported. She did everything the board asked, from fines to counseling to all the requirements. And it was more than 15 years ago. In that 15-year period, we have had an explosion of internet and social media and all the rest of it. And we all depend on websites much more than we did before. I don't want us to have the website idea hurting people or giving somebody else in your field some kind of an unfair advantage. I want it to be available. Let the buyer beware. Let the consumer see this. But if it's 15 years ago and you've done everything and your record is clean, you didn't hurt a patient, and all the things I mentioned, why should that be on the website? And so I think it's reasonable to take a fair look at this and say, not in the deeper expungement of records that get us all fouled up with federal regulations and all that. There are still permanent records where it will be there. But when someone goes to a website and you're a quality person and you've had a long record of care and professionalism, then why would you have a website give you a black eye? And I think going forward to the people that this could affect is the main thing. Sure. She would love to have this off the website before her last day of treating patients. But that's not the motivation here. Fairness is the motivation, and I think this bill approaches a very good balance of fairness. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Sebastian?
Chair Green Lincoln, nice to see you once again. I'm here just to provide some information for the committee, and I've provided some testimony. I think, Sandy, did you get the... actual testimony. Did you get the email?
Your name?
Oh, Patrick Brotz, Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. The Board of Dentistry created a website a number of years ago, and they did so in response to transparency. This website is looked at by consumers, by the public, by credentialing agencies, by insurance companies. And when we created the website, we have a website, and within the website we have something called a licensee lookup section, and I'm going to walk you through that in just a second. It provides all of the information about all of our licensees because people want that information. Before we had this website, we handled probably upwards to 25 to 50 phone calls a day, whether it be from consumers or insurance companies or credentialing people wanting to know, for example, if Representative Greenlick was a dentist, did he have a license, was it active, had there been any disciplinary information. If there was, then they wanted copies of that disciplinary information. We created the website and made it a complete website, so it's actually a primary source verification. If someone looks at that website, they know that we have primary sourced, verified all of the educational and examination information regarding those licensees so that they can take the ability to look at that website and say, yes, that person does have a license. We have about 7,700 licensees now for the Board of Dentistry. We've had this website for some time. If the board starts taking some of that information off, we can no longer say that it's a complete website. And therefore, what will happen then is people will have to pick up the phone to say, well, I looked on your site, but is that everything or is there something else that's missing? And at that point, we have to...
Sure. If you would, as you're walking us through it, let's say I had a disciplinary action in 1999 for not keeping proper records.
Right.
And I was disciplined, fined $600 or $5,000, whatever it was. How would it show on that when it got to me on that website? What would it look like?
If you can let me, I'll walk you through that. I actually have some examples so you can see that. If the committee wants to turn, and if you don't, I actually have some hard copies here. But this is actually what our website looks like, the front page. And there's a little section over in the corner that says Licensee Lookup. So you click on Licensee Lookup, and you'd get a page that would allow you to put in someone's name. And I happen to pick the president of our board, Dr. Hongo, and put in her name. What happens next is... you get a sheet that talks about Dr. Hongo. It says she's a dentist, gives her license number, tells when she was initially licensed, tells what her status, says she's active, tells when her current license expires, gives her business address, asks if she has any permits or endorsements. That would be if she had anesthesia permits. And then it says board action. It says there has been no discipline on this license. And then it says further, malpractice action, which was a new law that the legislature created about, I think, 6 or 7 years ago, that says there's been no reported malpractice on this license pursuant to ORS 742-400, effective July 17th, 2007. So in this case, this would be a person who has had no discipline. That's all you'd see. That's all that happens. In the next example that I put for the committee, which is example 3-1, it's an individual who, again, has had no discipline, but has had a malpractice action, which by that law says that if an action was commenced in court and there was a finding and there was a payout, the Board of Dentistry has to put that information on a website that's accessible to the public. Again, you would find that information, and George is right, it's red, okay? The next page, just like all of you, when you and I go into different apps and websites, it asks you to read some things and do you agree or do you not agree, comes up with that. And then it comes up with a category, a listing of all kinds of terms and information that you might find on that website. So what does probation mean? What does discipline mean? Gives you that opportunity. And then it finally goes to, in this case, it's a copy of the malpractice report that we received from the insurance company. Again, you can print that out if you want. You don't have to call the Board of Dentistry. Now, if you have some questions, you can, but it's pretty self-explanatory. The next person would have been someone, there's two types of malpractice actions. There's malpractice actions that we are required to post on our website, and there are malpractice actions that we are required to, if you call on the phone or you write us or you email us, to report that information to you. And again, I have examples of that, the same thing it would go through. And then finally is what Representative Greenlick was alluding to, is the last one, which is example 5-1. I just picked a dentist, and it, since it's public record, I'm not going to cite his name, but you can see this particular's name, and it says there's been action on this license. The next screen, again, you have to say you agree and go forward. It gives you the terms. And then finally what it does is it shows the exact consent order telling exactly what the person did, what the board found in its investigation, and what was the form of discipline. So all of that information is there. So to answer your question, Chair Greenlick, yes, if you had done something in 1995, you'd forgot to do something, you paid a $600 fine, it would tell what you forgot to do, it would tell what that fine was, it would tell what the date of this order was, and all of that information. Again, it's a complete site. You know, I can say the same thing. You know, I maybe don't like the fact that I got a speeding ticket a couple years ago, but if my insurance company looks at my record, they see it. Now, I know at some point those go off of my record. But insurance companies and consumers want this transparency. And I don't know any other way to give it to them that's the most efficient and cost-effective. I've actually submitted a fiscal note on this particular bill, because if we have to start taking things off the website, with the exception of malpractice, which we could not take down because that's a law, simply the site won't be complete anymore. I'm going to have staff to answer those questions again, to respond in writing. I mean, now it's a pretty simple process. It's pretty complete. It's pretty transparent. And I just don't know any other way around it. Now, I've had some conversations with George and the ODA about talking about some additional information we could put on the website, maybe putting different documents in front of consent orders that, you know, tell a little bit more about them. We can be more elaborative and do those kind of things. But again, I can't force someone to read them. I can only provide the information.
Okay, are there any questions, this panel?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You know, I guess, Mr. Chairman, I think this is an important bill to talk about, and I guess what I would say in light of some recent experience that I have had on behalf of a constituent, I think we have stumbled onto a gigantic iceberg. We have websites with enormous amounts of information. We don't necessarily have them accurate. Let me give you, if you would just indulge me, I'll try to make this brief. I was contacted.
I would ask you a brief.
I think it's relevant to this topic.
Wait, just let me. Yeah. My intention would be to close the public hearing after a little discussion and bring it back for a work session where we can spend more time. But I think we need to have the broader discussion
because exactly. I think there is a great deal of danger in data, because data is time-related and all kinds of things. Let me give you an example. This particular individual is licensed under a health licensing board. 3 years ago, this particular person had a complaint filed against them. That was put on the website, and there was notice on the website that she had a complaint filed against her. It took 2 years to settle that complaint, on which time that complaint sat there on the website, available to anybody who looked up her name, the same process that we're talking about here, and it had some rather significant accusations about her conduct and so forth, and quality of services. Then that subsequent complaint was resolved. It was resolved in a settlement agreement that found that there was no violation of law or ethics, and that there was no... Previously it had recommended supervision, so supervision was noted as checked as though she were under supervision and that it was required. And so all of this time she's had this mark, and then it's resolved, and then the board didn't bother to put the resolution on there, and also maintained, since she was getting consultation, which is different from supervision, that she was still under supervision. This is all outdated and inappropriate and inaccurate information from my perspective. Now, I think it needs a broader and more critical and careful look, but I think this is symptomatic of what we're doing in a lot of our health licensing boards that I think is a very frightening trend. And I consumers deserve to know exactly what's gone on. But we must be careful that what's gone on, this person has had a very difficult time making a living, because it would appear that she is dishonest, incompetent, and so on and so on. And apparently none of that was verifiable, because that's not what the record found when it was finally resolved. And even the fact that it was resolved was not clarified. So I just wonder if we're not stumbling on an iceberg here, that we need to look at all of our licensing boards and say, you know, this new technology needs to, we need to figure out how we're going to manage it better.
We'll have some discussion.
Thank you for indulging.
Chair Greenlink, if I might just ask at one point, in Oregon, complaints are not public information, so there are none in the Board of Dentistry. Notices are, but the Board of Dentistry chooses not to ever put a notice on a website until there's a resolution to it. So in, I can't talk about that board, but in regards to the Board of Dentistry, that would not happen in our case. A complaint issued does not go on the site until it is resolved.
And I appreciate, thank you very much for pointing that out. And I think, again, that bears out my point. There's inconsistency in management.
Let's stick to this bill. Let's make this brief. We've got a lot of work
just
today.
One quick question, and this is unfair to ask you this, but you might know. Do you have any knowledge of how many boards are doing this kind of thing? Is it widespread among licensing agencies, or
Chair Greenlink, Vice Chair Thompson?
Two now.
Yeah, I mean, basically, most of the boards have a website like this. Now, they don't all look the same; they're all a little bit different. But most of them have some form of a website that gives some kind of license information and some disciplinary.
So we could expect, however we handle this bill, we'll have all the other boards in.
Oh, absolutely.
Very briefly, please.
Yeah. So you mentioned you put a fiscal on it. Do we have that back, and can you tell me that amount?
I think for this biennium, it was somewhere around $60,000, and I think the next biennium is $90,000.
Okay. So if I might, just Mr. Chair, maybe we can spend a little time offline, but I like the bill. You know, I voted to let kids who slept with their underage girlfriend off the sex registry after a certain period of time. I'm fairly certain that there are some situations, we could figure out some sideboards, but there are some situations where if my dentist got caught, self-reported that they smoked pot at one point, I'm not sitting around worrying about that the website's not complete. I mean, I got other things to worry about. So I'd like you to work with us to figure something out, maybe, because the definition of not complete being the biggest problem, to me, that doesn't cut it. And spending $60,000 to $90,000, you know, to answer a few questions. I know we pay people salaries. They probably have a few hours in a day they have to talk to the public. So let's figure something out here, if we could.
Okay. I'm going to close this public hearing. Let's have some discussions offline. We'll bring it back to a work session where we spent some time talking about it. And thank you very much
thank
for bringing
you,
us our attention. I'm going to move. I want to close. Which hearing is this one?
This is Jensen.
I'm going to close the public hearing to House Bill 4070 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 4074. Ask Representative, I think we have this all settled, but we have to have a public hearing and ask Representative Jensen to come and briefly talk to us about this, and then...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4074 authorizes the Board of Medical Imaging to waive specified licensing requirements for individuals who meet certain criteria, declares an emergency effective on passage. You should have the dash 3 amendments and a dash 4 amendment on OLIS or in your with your meeting materials. And when we get to those, we can walk through them. Just so the committee knows, I do have all the appropriate paperwork on those amendments.
Okay, let's plan on making this about 15 minutes, and then we'll move to the next bill. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. My name is Bob Jensen, State Representative from House District 58. This bill comes to you, you know, from my office via the Hospital Association, I think, Rural Hospitals, as such, and I have, I think, a couple of able authorities here to discuss the particulars and answer questions, but I'll be happy to answer any question that that you might have or refer it to one of the folks here with me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I've been around, or somebody from our association has been around to, I believe, all of you to talk about this bill. So let me go over it very quickly, and we will keep this under your 15 minutes.
I'd like to move it in that time as well.
That'd be great. Okay, what had happened was in 2011, there was a bill that expanded the licensing for imaging techs. So where you think of an imaging technician as taking x-rays and having an x-ray license, it expanded that to the modalities within that you had to additionally have a license in ultrasound, in nuclear medicine, in MRI, so all the different variations, you would have to also prove that you had experience, knowledge, skills, and ability in those areas as well. That bill passed, and what we found in the interim was that for our rural areas, it was very difficult to meet the federal guidelines and the federal standards for some of those modalities. For instance, nuclear medicine, if you're already doing nuclear medicine imaging out in a rural area and you now want to get your separate license for that, you would have had to have 8,000 hours of practice. And for the rural areas, this is pretty much impossible. They're not specialists usually in a hospital or a clinic. They are, you know, kind of a jack of all trades. So our folks went to Mr. Conlaw from the Imaging Board and talked to him about solutions. And the solution that they came up with is in this bill. What it does is it sort of turns it over to the Imaging Board to say, we will accept a waiver from a person, maybe it's Representative Greenlee, and he says, I can't meet those hours. I don't get that many people for nuclear medicine in my clinic or my hospital. So he applies for a waiver. Mr. Conlaw's board will accept that waiver and either deny it, approve it, or approve it with some sideboards. Maybe they need to have some more hours of education, or maybe they need some closer supervision. It'll all be independent. And that's basically the crux of the bill. It's only for type A and B hospitals. It's not for DRG hospitals, so not for the big ones. It's for our rural hospitals. There are some dash 3 amendments, and the dash 3 amendments actually do three things. it changes a time period of 10 years to substantial experience so that the board can then decide what is substantial experience, whether it's 10 years, 5 years, 20 years. The second one was it changed CAHS. You're all familiar with the CAHS hospitals, critical access hospitals, which is a federal designation, versus what we do in this state for rural hospitals, which are A's and B's. It was the wrong site, so we just changed the site. And the third one is having to sit for a national exam. If you don't meet the qualifications to sit for it, the board can actually, as a state agency, sponsor you, and then they will tell the examining board what types of parameters they have put around you taking this test without the proper hours or whatever it is. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Conlaw to correct any misstatements I've made.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ed Conlow. I'm the executive director of the Board of Medical Imaging. The Hospital Association worked closely with us on this, brought us in at the beginning, and presented it to our board at our last meeting, discussed the amendment, -3 amendment with us. We feel that it is a workable and reasonable waiver provision.
I'm going to ask Representative Kenny Geyer to introduce the -4s. I want to make sure you don't have a problem with the -4s. We haven't found anybody that does.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Jensen, for both bringing the original bill and correcting an unintended consequence from a previous bill, and also allowing me to introduce an amendment for an unintended consequence from a bill that we passed last year that was aimed at restricting the use of ultrasound to certain professions. And we listed a variety of professions, physicians, nurses, et cetera. There was some concern at the time from acupuncturists and chiropractors, are we going to be considered physicians in this? Because we've always had the right to do, to order ultrasounds, not necessarily interpret, but to order them. And LC said, well, we think so, but, you know, nothing, you never know until you actually go to the court by it. What the group that didn't realize that they weren't listed in it was the licensed direct entry midwives who have been ordering ultrasounds for the past 20 years. This was no change that we're coming back and saying, whoops, we had an unintended consequences. We've knocked certain licensed healthcare practitioners from ordering ultrasounds in what is a really important piece of their practice to make sure that the development of the fetus is progressing as it should, or if there are any problems, to be able to diagnose that. So this -4 amendment is meant to broaden the language from, instead of listing certain professions, to say that any ultrasounds can be ordered and interpreted by any licensed healthcare professionals acting within the scope of their license. There are certain healthcare professionals that have within the scope of their license the ability to order, and it maintains, it doesn't change that at all. And then there are an even more restricted number of healthcare practitioners that are trained and licensed to interpret those. This bill does not change that. So it's just a wording language in the bill.
Are there any questions in this panel? Thank you very much. I will.
And I just want to also say that the thank you to the director of the Board of Imaging, as well as Holly Mercer from the Oregon Health Licensing, and everyone coming to the table and finding the right language.
Close the public hearing. And open a work session on House Bill 4074. Do we have a
representative?
Oh, yes.
Motion on the floor.
Chair, I move to adopt the -3 amendment dated 2/3/14 and the -4 amendment dated 2/4/14.
A motion from Representative Kenny.
Did you want to do it one at a time?
No, we can do them together.
Okay.
Motion from Representative Kenny Geyer to adopt the -3 amendment dated 2/3/14 and the -3 amendments dated 2/4/14. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Any objection? The amendments are adopted. A motion on the bill?
Chair, I move House Bill 4074 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We I have a motion from Representative Kenny Geyer to move House Bill 4074 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Guyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. So Representative Jensen and Representative Kenny Guyer co-chair this. We'll talk about the pieces of it. Thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. And thank you both for helping get it to this point. I close the work session.
Stand at ease a sec. Can you stand at ease for a second?
What are you doing?
The cover organ is getting your eyes.
Hold on, man. We close the work session on House Bill 4074.
I did.
4074. Do you have a motion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that we suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Conger to vote on those first two bills.
We have a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Conger to vote on two prior bills. Any objection? So moved. How do you vote, Representative Conger?
Aye and aye.
You have that? So moved.
Okay.
Stand at ease for a couple moments, please.
Thank you.
On House Bill 4154, can I ask Representative Kagan to join us?
Sir? Yeah. I don't know where Representative Fagan is.
She's right there.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Somebody said you had a panel.
She appeared magic.
She did. I'm so sorry. I apologize.
And we have with us also the director, the acting director of the Oregon Health Authority. Let's go. Wait a minute. Let me make a statement here first. This is, I think, an important bill, and we've had lots of time in this session to beat up on Cover Oregon and to find out who is at fault and all that kind of stuff. I hope that's not what we're doing here. We have a specific bill aimed at fixing some of the problems that we've all recognized, and I really like to keep our discussion as much as possible to the relevance of this bill before us today. You have the floor.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shamia Fagan. I'm the state representative for House District 51, which includes Outer Southeast Portland, Southwest Gresham, Boring, Damascus, Happy Valley, and unincorporated Clackamas County. We all agree that one of the biggest issues that we need to tackle for Oregonians this February is Cover Oregon. We also all agree there have been massive failures in Cover Oregon. And I'm here today with House Bill 4154 because I think we can all also agree that Oregonians should not be the ones who pay the price for those failures. I also believe that we can all agree that our North Star in this conversation is and remains affordable health care for all Oregon families. I'm going to talk quickly about what this bill does broadly, and then I'm going to dive into the details, and then obviously happy to take any questions that you have. What this bill does essentially is three things. One, it helps people. Two, it makes sure that we have the tools to hold people who caused this debacle accountable. And three, it takes the critical first steps to make sure that this never happens again in Oregon. The largest part of this bill, for sure, is helping people. And in that regard, it essentially does four things. One, it directs the Cover Oregon Board to seek a waiver from the federal government to extend the enrollment period to April 30th. This is to make sure that Oregonians who have been diligent, who've turned in their paperwork on time, are held harmless by the fact that the enrollment process is taking longer than it should. The second piece of this is to direct the Cover Oregon Board to seek a waiver to make sure that Oregonians, and we all know them, we all know the constituents we have, who maybe went on the website, shopped a little bit, but couldn't complete the process on the website because of the technical problems. So they went around the website directly to the carrier and purchased insurance. We want to make sure that those Oregon families get the tax relief that they deserve. Same for Oregon small businesses, for the Oregon small businesses who chose to provide health insurance for their employees that weren't able to do so through the exchange because of the problems with which we are all very familiar. That they went around the exchange and directly to the insurer. We want to make sure that Oregon's small businesses get the tax relief they deserve. And finally, for a small group of Oregonians with extremely high medical needs, critical, ongoing, and chronic medical needs, that we make sure that they continue to be covered from January 1st until the time in which they are fully enrolled in a private insurance plan. In closing, this bill cuts through the politics, and it gives us all an opportunity to come together and to do something right for Oregonians, to make sure that Oregon families and Oregon small businesses are protected from the failures of Cover Oregon. I urge your support, and I'm certainly happy to take any questions that you have.
Ms. Edlin, do you have any opening comments you want to make?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm here actually today to answer questions about the temporary medical insurance program as part of this bill, so as we have this discussion, I can answer those questions.
Great. Okay, the floor is open. Any questions? Representative Conger?
Thank you. So it was reported in the middle of last month, I think, that the governor had sought a waiver without a lot of detail about it, but it sought a waiver to allow people who had gone around the exchange to obtain the tax credits, which is effectively what we're talking about with this bill. How does this differ from what the governor apparently has already done, and do we know whether or not the waiver was approved? Do we have any idea where that stands in process?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, one thing that's been incredibly clear is everything that's come out from Cover Oregon. I was not actually here in the 2011 session when it was passed, but one thing that's become abundantly clear is the legislature should have taken a more active role, a more direct role in managing and overseeing Cover Oregon. What this bill does is it remedies that by, regardless of what the governor has done, this bill directs and requires the Cover Oregon Board to seek the waiver. So it allows the legislature to step up and provide the checks and balances and to make sure that we are taking an active role in doing what the Oregon legislature needs to do to make sure that Oregonians are not harmed.
I'm not sure if I was clear about that.
Representative Conger, do you know anything about the governor?
Yes, Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger. Yes, those discussions have started on the part of the governor's office with the secretary to ask for that waiver. No conclusion to those discussions. They've just started. It's always, I would say, always good to have legislative support for those kinds of discussions. It shows that the state is behind that effort.
So do you want to join us, Senator?
If you'd like me to, Representative, I'm here for the next bill. But
okay. All right.
We have a lot of questions for you.
She's like, I'm leaving. Bye.
You want to follow up on that?
Yeah. I didn't hear from either of you whether you know there's any difference between the waiver request that's already been made, and I understand, you know, legislative support may be good, may help the governor, I guess, prosecute the case, but is it different? Do we know what he applied or what the governor's staff applied for? Is it through April 30th? Is it the same thing?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, it's... Again, discussions have just started. It wasn't actually a formal application, so I think the concept is the same, but it was just the concept was introduced in those discussions.
No one else wants to go. I'll keep going.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Go for it.
You might ask what I was going to ask.
Hey, you have a question?
You can continue, and I'll
see if it's... All right, then you're next.
And then Clem.
I was just kind of wondering about, you know, the April 30th deadline. I think we're already under an extension of the open enrollment period in the first quarter, or is that not true? And that wasn't really my question. I guess it doesn't matter. I think we are, the open enrollment period has been extended already. The website still doesn't work. I don't know, and I don't think anyone else really knows when it will. So what happens if the website doesn't work by April 30th? Because I think at this point it would be prudent to be contemplating that might happen again, because it's happened again and again and again. So maybe it happens again, maybe it doesn't. If it doesn't work, what do we do? And if it does, what do we have any, and this is really more of a question for the agency.
Can we ask?
Do we have any idea how many?
We have a Cover Oregon representative that can. David, can you join us? In case you can try and answer that question. We don't have your boss here.
David looks excited to be up here.
Yeah.
Hi, Mr. Chair, Representative Conger. I'm Dave Barenberg, and I'm representing Cover Oregon.
Basically, the question before you is if we extend the open enrollment period, if we get permission to extend it to April 30th, and the website isn't operational by that point, what will we do with the ability to enroll people during that open enrollment period?
How are we going to? Presumably, we just do the continue to use the paper application process, which is not setting the world on fire. And but the corollary is what happens on April 30th if the website still doesn't work.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, we continue trying to make the improvements in the process with the hybrid process we're doing and enroll as many people as we can to move through the process. Also, the enrollment period is currently through March 31st, which is what it has been from the beginning. What there was is an extension, I think, in terms of the time the feds gave for people to qualify or to choose health plans and not be subject to the penalty under the federal IRS requirements.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Conger, if I could also respond. Just looking at that piece in isolation isn't sufficient because you have to look at the entire bill, because the other waivers that we're seeking are to allow Oregonians for this tax year to go directly to carriers. And so your assumption is only that still the exchange would be the only way through which they could access the tax credits by April 30th or their cost savings. And this bill would also allow Oregonians who have already gone around the exchange due to the technical problems to access the tax relief. And if they have that option going forward, then that's also another way through which Oregonians can get health insurance, because that is ultimately always the ultimate goal here, to make sure that people get coverage that's affordable.
Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Fagan, for bringing this forward, and for Tina for stepping up to the plate and during a challenging time. I guess I wanted clarification too, because especially around what the waiver is that the governor already sought. My understanding is that the waiver was to allow health insurance to continue to provide plans that they've done in the past that may not be ACA compliant, but allow it until this new system is in place. And some have chosen to do that through March 31st, and some have chosen to do that for the entire year. So that's the first part of my question. Is my understanding of the waiver that he requested correct? The second is that where I see this is a little bit different is that I don't remember in the discussion of his waiver any request in that for subsidies. And what I see is different in this is that it's requesting that for people, not anyone, not just go around the exchange, but for people who tried to go through exchange, weren't able to do it because of the problems of the exchange, that they would then get the subsidies that otherwise would have been available to them up until, you're asking, until April 1st, well, I guess you're asking until May 1st as opposed for 4 months of the year as opposed to 3 months. So I want to make sure that I'm clear about the differences that you were starting to ask about the governor's waiver request and this waiver request.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer. I think my understanding is the second, not the first, is that was the discussions that the governor had. But what I'd like to propose is that I can go back and I can bring back to the committee or get delivered to you what the substance of the conversations were.
Representative Clem, then Wyden.
Yeah, just two things. One. So I read this newspaper story the other day about the agent online portal that is working. It was sort of interesting. It was a story about two different brokers, and one had paper only and was pretty frustrated, and the other guy had moved like 1,000 people through in 2 days or something like that. It was quite striking. So I'm just wondering a little bit, this is more David while I got you there, is that electronic system that is working, something that... this model of having people, for now, if the paper thing isn't working out, go to your insurance agent, go through that. Is it working as well as that story said, where he moved a lot of people in? If I'm going to get one and a half here, I'll just say the other one, since he's not listening to me right now and not going to rule me out of order. So after our hearing the other day, I happened to run into the governor, and I mentioned, actually, when Representative Congress said the other day, we probably ought to look at this tax credit thing, and he said, yeah, we're sending some people back there, and we're looking into that. So I know it would be appreciated to have, a little more oomph, because it's not a done deal, but I think several states are asking. I think it's, I stole your idea, sorry, but I thought it would be helpful to do this. So I'm glad to see a bill. I'm hoping I can add my name on there if you don't mind. I don't think I have to ask you, but I'm just trying to while you're on the spot. So,
Chair Greenlick, Representative Clem. We are making progress and working on a number of the aspects of the application process. I know that a number of agents have still significant problems and a backlog of applications that we're working through for them. So there's progress being made, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
But that online portal thing, I didn't even know there was one for them. So they are doing things electronically. Or is the story not really... So right.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Clem, there are more things that we're able to do in sort of a hybridized process, but we're not quite yet doing the end-to-end piece that we would envision from the start. So that we are able to, in some agents, to move more expeditiously through the process with some new tools that have become available, and we hope to make more to enhance that.
Senator Wyden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's lots of different questions I have on this, but one of them is just why the April 30th deadline? Because that's just adding another 30 days. Odds are the website's still not going to be working. The way things are looking, I wouldn't be surprised if we don't end up using the federal exchange or another state exchange, because we can't keep throwing hundreds of millions of dollars after this. For guys who don't know what they're doing in developing a website, apparently. Why did we select April 30th? We should have been looking further out to allow people to purchase from insurance agents, health insurance, and get the tax credit. So I'm just kind of curious why you selected that date.
The whole idea behind this bill is to put forward real, practical solutions that we can actually get done for Oregonians. Certainly, it sounds better, and I am open if we could actually know that we can get a waiver for a later date. I'm incredibly open to a later date, mm-hmm. but I wanted to have a date that I believe that we can actually get done. And when our team was working on this bill and looking at it, April 30th is a realistic solution for Oregonians. But I'm certainly open to a longer date if we believe that we can get it done. What I'm not interested in is a longer date that simply sounds good and we don't actually move anything forward for Oregonians.
You have another one? You have a follow-up?
There's tons of audits and stuff. You didn't want us going down the rabbit trail.
Yeah, it's a whole different...
And, I mean, there's lots of questions I have about where the money went for this. I mean, over... $48 million to $170 million, I believe we're at now, close to $200 million for a website that doesn't work. And we're looking at giving another 30 days. I have lots of problems.
Representative Lively?
Thank you. I applaud the efforts. So my first question has to do with the waivers. And so we're assured, we're comfortable, we believe, I mean, it goes back to ultimately the federal has to agree to the waiver. So, again, regardless of the date, what comfort level do we have that that's something they're going to approve, or why wouldn't they?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Lively, we're certainly not assured of anything. This is, there's no foregone conclusions. But again, we want to put forward pragmatic solutions that, of things we believe we can actually get done. There certainly has been research that's gone into what date, what's the farthest date that we can get. And certainly, like I said, I'm open to longer dates. I don't necessarily want it to be April 30th. I'm happy to extend it for as long as we need to ultimately hit the goal of affordable access to health coverage for Oregonians. But we want, again, we want pragmatic, realistic solutions that we can actually get done for Oregonians.
This is only what we're asking for, anyhow. You have a follow-up?
Yeah, sure. And so, not that I don't believe we'll get this, but so, in order to accomplish the things we talked about, helping people, tools, hotel, so if we don't get the waiver, what's our fallback position, or where are we? We just do the best we can do within the time frame we have, or is there something else, given how short the session is there something else, some other way we might address this?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Lively, we always do the best we can in the time frame that we have, because whether it's March 31st or April 30th, Oregonians need health coverage. That's the whole North Star in this entire process. So I'm certainly open to any amendments, but I feel confident that if the legislature joins together with the governor and directs the Cover Oregon Board to seek these waivers, I feel a good degree of confidence that we will get those waivers.
That assumes the governor hasn't replaced the board by the it is in the bill, right?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a question for you. Would you be open to, like, an amendment if we added, like, a federal forensic auditor come in with this? I mean, we should be held accountable for this, but somebody outside of us, where we had a federal forensic auditor come in and audit our books, is what's happened with this money, where it's went, what's been done with it, to go with this. That's true accountability, and that's what we should be looking at.
I would be glad to consider an amendment if it's under the relating to clause, or to help you
find another
bill.
I can make it work under this one. I can make it work under this one.
Mr. Chair, while we're at it, can I compel a federal auditor for the federal forest, too? I've got a bunch of actually audits for the federal government. I'd like to compel them to come here.
I think we need a stronger bill that compels the federal government to do stuff.
Because they're burning down, it turns out.
A different problem. Yes.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, since we have both Cover Oregon and Oregon Health Authority represented here, what you think about the April 30th date in here? What are your thoughts?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer. I agree with Representative Fagan that the goal here is to do something that we could get done and that it's doable, and that, you know, it's the date that we have discussed with the federal government at this point.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, I agree with my colleague to my left. Thank you.
Representative Richardson, you've signed up both to testify, if you'd like to do that, or to ask questions, or both, one or the other, or both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to talk about some amendments before we're done with this discussion, but I would like to say that I applaud the intent of the bill and the provisions. I think that this needs to be done. It doesn't go quite far enough, and that's where we would need to have some appropriate amendments. But certainly, we need to care for those OMIP patients, the chronic patients who have no coverage without the provisions that are provided here, and the tax extensions make sense. So I believe that this is appropriate, and I'm glad to see that Representative Fagan would be willing to address amendments to the bill. Because we have a good relating clause, this is the bill. And so let's make it work for a number of things.
I haven't seen any proposed amendments, but we're not going to work this bill, obviously, today. So there's time to get us proposed amendments, and let's see what they are. Absolutely.
When you're ready, I'd like to just mention two of them for the record today, but it doesn't need to be at this moment.
Well, go ahead.
We have a couple of issues here. One is what needs to be done to enable coverage for our citizens. That's what this bill so far is doing. The Cover Oregon issue is kind of a separate issue because the coverage is not dependent on the website. And so, you know, but they both ought to be addressed. The Cover Oregon issue is a major drain on funds. I mean, you see many, many numbers that have gone out. We're somewhere under $200 million that have been spent on the program, and we haven't enrolled anyone, and there's no date to do that.
I would propose one amendment, which has actually been drafted for a different bill, but there's no sense in having multiple bills, but so it'd be very easy to do, which would essentially shut down the website portion of Cover Oregon and have us seek to utilize the federal exchange for signing up people, and that can be done. And if that wasn't desired, there's other states that are already working. The justification for that is that we're spending more money to try and duplicate what's already working elsewhere, and it's good money after bad because we can. There's already systems that are working, and this one is not working, and there's no date when it might start to work. In addition to that, Cover Oregon is destined to be shut down anyway, because Rocky King from the very beginning said, if we can't make Cover Oregon self-sufficient, then we're not going to use general funds for it. Well, Director Goldberg has said that the federal funds end at the end of this year, and so next year we're going to have to be self-sufficient. To break even, there needs to be 145,000 individual policyholders in Cover Oregon, which is not going to happen. And then the second thing is the budget for Cover Oregon would have to be diminished by 20%. Only if you have both of those requirements would Cover Oregon be able to break even. And if it doesn't break even, that means that we're going to have general funds or raising fees, but we have a plan that isn't working, that isn't necessary because it's duplicative, and it's not sustainable financially. So that would be the basis for that one amendment.
Certainly we could have a debate on that amendment. Actually, what you're saying, I think, probably is not going to make sense, because the fact is it's probably not feasible to tie into the federal plan. I mean, for example, some states have one health plan. We have 11 health plans. In order to tie into that federal plan, we need to be modifying things starting now in time for October 1st in order to relate to our piece of it. And I suspect that's not a feasible alternative. But we have asked Cover Oregon to give us a plan for that. And I think it's premature to assume in advance where we're going with this until we know what it is, what their fail-safe time is, and what they propose to do about it. The financial situation is, I think, a whole different question. I've seen numbers much lower than 150,000 if they can get a 20% reduction in their operating budget. But again, those are, I think, not really a part of today's discussion, but one that I would be happy to have in this committee as a possibility at a different time.
Chair Greenlick, if I may, and Representative
Sure, Bill,
Richardson.
You definitely may.
I'm certainly open to amendments to this bill, but what I want to be very clear about is what I don't want to happen to this bill is I don't want this bill to get bogged down into the obvious politics around this issue. Because as this bill stands right now, this is something we can all agree on. Because regardless of those who believe that Cover Oregon should be shut down versus those that believe it should move forward, regardless of where you fall on that, that does not change the fact that today there are Oregon families who deserve tax relief they couldn't get because of technical glitches in the website. And there are Oregon small businesses who deserve tax relief they couldn't get because of glitches in the website. So what I don't want to happen is to take a bill like this that's full of solutions that I believe we can all get behind, because they're real solutions for Oregonians. Regardless of what you think the future of Cover Oregon should be, this is the reality for Oregon families and small businesses now. So what I don't want to happen with this bill, we all had two bills in this session to bring forward. This was one of my priority bills. Everybody had an opportunity to put the solutions that they believed in their own bills. I brought this one forward because I wanted to have real solutions for Oregonians that I believe we can actually accomplish now.
I think that's exactly where the committee would want to go as well. I think you're right. Somebody, Representative Thompson, you haven't had a comment. You want to?
No, I have an amendment, but we're not at that point.
Okay.
I just wanted to ask for the record, because I thought you had said that no one had enrolled yet, and I just wanted to get an update from Cover Oregon, hopefully, David.
No one enrolled?
On what? Maybe I misheard, but
it's through the website.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. But it would be helpful anyway to hear, because we try to get this every month or so. What are the numbers so far?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, the numbers are, and I don't have them off the top of my head. I can check back in my book, but I think we've enrolled close to 33,000 or so people in commercial plans, and then somewhere in the neighborhood, I'll check, about 60,000 through the website in the Oregon Health Plan. And that's in addition to the fast-tracked enrollments that have happened through OHA's fast-track
which
process.
Which is up to how much now?
Total enrollment now, including both sides, is around 215,000.
Yes, and where is
yes, Mr. Chair, just to emphasize what David has said, that's 33,000 individual policyholders. The rest have all gone on Medicaid. And so the mere fact that they may have been enrolled as part of Cover Oregon's process does not mean that they're individual policyholders. And so with 33,000 after 3 months, the chances of getting to 145,000 or even a lesser figure by next year is a huge jump. And I certainly understand the concern that maybe we wouldn't want to burden a bill with something extremely controversial, but I would hope that your committee would consider hearings on these other issues in a separate bill.
Are there, yes.
Actually, real quick, David, just for clarification as well. Just round numbers here, 33,000. So we have 33,000 full-paying customers, or are some of those subsidized in that 33,000?
They're all subsidized.
Yeah. Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, a number of them are subsidized through the federal tax credits. Not all, but a number of. And
and that's the January 1st effective date? We have numbers for the February effective date yet?
Chair Greenlick, we have that number is how many people that so far have enrolled, and I can get the committee members specific up-to-date numbers. That's a round number that's a few days old. That were enrolled as of the current date. So some would have started January 1st, some will have a February 1st effective date, and then as we roll forward, some will have March 1st effective dates.
Representative Conger, I think I'm about to run out here. We have one more witness that would like to testify, and we'll get that witness.
So, first of all, I have objected repeatedly to including the Medicaid population in the enrollment numbers. That's not what Cover Oregon was billed as, at least not in this committee. It's not a Medicaid enrollment online site. It's a site where you're supposed to be able to shop for plans. The number that the business plan is keyed off of, which we've been batting back and forth, and I don't think any of us really knows anymore what the number is, but I am quite confident when the first business plan was shown to us, the expectation was over 200,000 plans, not Medicaid, private plans. I know that to be true. So if this is supposed to be a self-sustaining organization, I think the public should probably know, first of all, how many, let me break it down for you, how many people have enrolled, what are their demographics, are they sick, are they the higher cost end of the spectrum, because many of us have been concerned that those are the people who will sign up through the website, and the people who are healthy won't do it. They will accept the penalty because it makes more economic sense when you're 25 years old and you're not at high risk to need health insurance to just take the penalty instead of paying the high cost of the plans. I have asked for those numbers. We need those numbers to understand who's signing up. This whole concept is predicated on a certain kind of population, a certain kind of pool resulting. And this Cover Oregon corporation becoming entirely self-sustaining based on charges that are added to the cost of the premiums that are sold through Cover Oregon, through the website, or by hand. I mean, I assume we're charging I think it's 5%. Right, it's 5% we're charging right now, in addition to the cost of the premium, to cover, the handwritten application process. And what I'm wondering is, and I support completely the idea of trying to help people who were forced outside the exchange. The purpose of the bill is good. I'm just wondering why we keep kicking the can down the road when I really believe if we had a full picture of what's going on, we would probably conclude that it's never going to work. People don't trust it, or they're electing because they're healthy not to sign up through Cover Oregon. So effectively what we're doing is we're continuing this on.
I really think we need to focus on this bill. I think you have some legitimate concerns.
No, Mr. Chair, this is part of this bill. The point is that it's an extension to April 30th, during which time we continue to spend money on something we don't know whether it's going to work. And I'm not even addressing the website. I'm talking about, is it ever going to be at a point where it makes sense to keep spending the money? Should we be asking for a waiver that is permanent? I'm going to offer an amendment to say, let's make the waiver permanent.
Let's wait till we get the amendments on the floor, and we'll talk about it. But at this point, I think all the general concerns you have and others of us have, and we've asked them to provide information for us. We haven't had a chance to bring them back because we're trying to work these bills. But we need to get that information, and we need to be on top of it. In the meantime, we have a bill in front of us, and I'd like to, we have to deal with these bills by next Wednesday. I'd like to focus on bills we actually have rather than on...
Mr. Chair, fair comment. So I will, since I'm obviously running afoul of the guy with the gavel.
Not too afoul.
I will conclude by saying I feel like in order to know how to properly craft this bill, I would benefit from actually having good information about who's signing up, how many people have to sign up before this becomes self-sustaining, because it goes to the issue of how long should the waiver be?
David, we're going to have a work session on this bill with invited testimony. It'd be very useful if you could get Dr. Goldberg in for an updated statement on, particularly on that question, a little further question that we asked him about what would make it self-sufficient with a 20% reduction in operating budget. What would be the membership numbers that would be required to that for the 2015 self-sufficiency? That's a very important question.
Can I ask one more question for them to come back to?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just wondering because, you know, I would love to get your best guess on what you think increased enrollment will be between now and the end of the enrollment period for this year versus October versus December, because I think what you're proposing is, you know, pull the plug now, and I'm wondering what are you thinking in terms of our second crack at it when hopefully things are more aligned. I know the breakdown of the website was a huge piece of it. You've been struggling to catch up ever since with processing paper applications. We talked last time about customer service, and that's partly because you've been running and trying to catch up. So, you know, keeping that in mind for the current enrollment challenges and projections versus October through December, at the time at which our federal subsidies start running out, and we're going to have to make some hard decisions by then. And I guess I'm looking for more of that information before we make a decision now about that.
Mr. Kenner, last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, you know, and I applaud the effort to find a solution. I just think we're looking at a very inadequate solution. And I just think maybe we need to have a little broader discussion about how we're going to formulate a plan to deal with the crisis that we are moving into. And that looks to me like that's probably beyond the scope of this committee. It's probably a special session or something, because I mean, the train wreck is pretty obvious. So I don't know how we find something to help us in this in-between time before the train wreck occurs so that we minimize the damage, I guess. But
that might be light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, and boy, would that be a blessing. And let's hope so.
Are you asking for a special session?
Mr. Chair.
Well, I think we're going to have to deal with this.
I will say this does help. I know a few constituents, I think they're taken care of now, and we're able to work through the issues with them that got hit by this, but there's probably still a few people out there that haven't got it squared away yet that this probably could help with the extra 30 days. But I think everybody can hear the frustration because we've never got real numbers from anybody. I've asked for how many 18 to 26-year-olds, all these different questions. We come in here, we ask them all the time, and we never get the answers.
We've got another frustration bill we want to hear it.
That you're hearing.
You get the actual last word.
Thank you, Mr.
I'll
Chair.
I'll ask Melissa Unger to join us at the front.
In following through with some of the concerns that Representative Conger had, I would like to put on the table, and we can discuss this, the option of bringing in someone who early on in this process, when we were having Discover Oregon euphoria, offered to take this on as a private contractor and claims to be able to do what we want done in a very efficient and quick manner. So if we're looking for, do we shut it down, do we not shut it down, whatever, I think we need to look at that private option and whether or not there's any viability there. I'm not going to speak to anybody in particular right now, but because that would be unfair. But we're saying either we have to shut it down or we have to build it up. Maybe there's another option that it could be. We could move on very quickly. I think we need to look at that in terms of not only cost savings, but efficiency.
We have a bill in front of us. I'll ask you if you have an amendment that's relevant to that bill to get it to us by, say, Friday, so we can have a chance to look at it. We'll open this bill back up for a work session on Monday, where we'll have invited testimony, and we'll take a look at it. And then I think we have a bigger task ahead of us when we finish our bills to begin to plan for the future, which we can do. I think this is the place for it, actually.
Yeah.
And we can be talking about how we do that when we're done with this session's work. We'll have some time to work on it, because I think there are fears, concerns, there's the reality and the fantasy life and a bunch of things that we get to it. I'll dismiss you guys. Thank you for your testimony. I'll ask Melissa Unger to briefly testify, and then we'll close this public hearing and open a public hearing on the last bill we have on the agenda.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. Hopefully I get to end this on a slightly lighter note, talking about some of the people who have actually signed up for this, because my name is Melissa Unger, and I am the director of the State Council for the Service Employees Union, SEIU. And for the last 4 months, I've actually had the opportunity to run a program signing people up through Cover Oregon on paper applications through the Affordable Care Act. And we've signed up nearly 5,000 people on paper applications. So every frustration you've heard, I've heard a lot with the Cover Oregon process. And I'll be the first to acknowledge and admit that this process needs fixing, and that Oregonians need assurances that it's being taken seriously. But I do want to tell you a particular story that really struck me, and it's about a member that we have down in Grants Pass named Sherry Hendricks. Sherry Hendricks, I got introduced to her on January 4th when I got a call from the hospital trying to track down whether she had insurance or not, because she had fallen down some stairs and broken her ankle. And she said, well, I got signed up back in November, so I have insurance. And so we spent the next 10 days working together to figure out where her insurance was. And indeed, she did have insurance through MOTA. And it took a while to figure that out. And we actually, I was really happy the day she called me. She got a $600 ambulance bill. And we were able to put her MOTA insurance ID number on it, and she was able to send it back without a check to figure out where that went. The reason I think that story is important is it was hard, right? We spent 15 days trying to figure out if she had insurance. That was a big pain for her, and she was in the hospital. It was very stressful. But if she would have fallen down the stairs on December 30th, she would have had no insurance and years of debt. And that story can be told over and over and over again, and the people that we've signed up through the Affordable Care Act, she's not on Medicaid. She's on the qualified health plan. And so those stories are like, they're out there. And there's another story of this guy who I signed up at the Red Lion, and he was leaving, and he was so happy. And I was like, oh, why, you know, did you not have insurance before? And he said, no, I had insurance, But you know what? My wife has never been able to get insurance for the last 5 years because she's a little overweight. And this guy just looked at me and he said, you know what? My wife's not fat. I don't know why she couldn't get insurance. And for him, it was just the moment that he got to sign her up and pay for her insurance was so amazing to him. And I think that those stories are important because what we need to do is we need to fix it. We can't throw it away. We can't just walk away from what we've built. What we need to do is we need to fix it. And for the thousands of people who we've worked with, I'll be the first to tell you that the website caused a lot of problems. I don't understand why there wasn't a backup plan. I don't understand why the paper process didn't work as well as it should have. It's working a lot better now. I can attest to that. I don't know why it didn't at the beginning. They should have had that plan. But for Sherry, we just need to figure out how to make it smoother. And I think this bill is actually takes some steps to do that. It protects Oregonians to the best that we can, I think, in terms of setting up some procedures to make sure people get tax credits. My understanding is the part about April 30th is if they apply by March 31st, since it's a two-step process now to get insurance, you have to apply, get determined eligible, and then you have to enroll. And so that piece is a two-step process, so we need to make sure that our timelines line up with the federal timelines, because then people will be really confused about when they're allowed to apply, since the federal deadline is March 31st. So we need to make sure if someone submitted a paper application on March 31st, because that's what every paper is going to say to do, that they still have time to enroll in a plan and get a tax credit. And so that's really critical in our current process if we continue to have to be on paper and we don't have a website. We also support the accountability pieces. We think that we need to continue to look at the budget piece. Where's the legislature in oversight in that budget? That's an important issue going forward. How do we make sure that the governor has oversight over the agency director to make sure there's a clear line of accountability? All of these things matter, but what really matters are the people that we've been able to sign up, like Sherry, because I know that her life would have been dramatically different for the next couple of years if she would have tried to pay that bill because she fell down the stairs 2 days later. And so I think the real thing that we have to do here is figure out how we fix this. And so I look forward to continuing to be a part of a conversation around this. We believe that this bill is an important first step for all of those things. So thank you very much.
Any questions?
Real quick one.
Yep.
Listen, I think what you're saying, I mean, everybody up here agrees with, but I think our frustration is more all of these people that have signed up, we could have, with the money we've spent, we could have bought them all insurance plans for 7 years, and it wouldn't have cost them a dime. So, and that's what we're frustrated about.
Except we didn't have that money. That money came to us because of this process. And the notion is, it'll, once we get it straightened out, assuming it works, it'll be there for the future. So, I mean, we are building for the future, if we can figure out how to make it work.
Yeah.
Melissa, thank you very much. Another question?
30 seconds or less?
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Yes.
So I would bring this up later in amendments, but the relating clause won't work. So the vice chair talked about another private option. I feel like Oracle was the private option. So since I can't bring up my public option amendment, since it won't fit in the relating clause, I want to talk about public options because that's where we just automatically move people. And if more people had a public option, they wouldn't have this problem because they wouldn't be looking for insurance. So maybe someday I can talk about that. Then we don't have to pay CEOs of insurance companies $250 million, blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah. Okay. Thank you very much. I close the public hearing on 4154. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 4137. We have my esteemed senator I saw back there, Representative Stringer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4137 appropriates monies to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services for the Primary Health Care Loan Forgiveness Program, declares an emergency effective on passage. Mr. Chair, I have no amendments at this time. We do have a fiscal and a revenue on this bill. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
David Wall is also going to join us. Representative, Senator, you pick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I always let my senator go first because she's senior.
Look at you. I don't even know how you begin to describe me as senior. You, Representative. Mr. Chair, Vice
Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Planer here, State Senator for District 17, which does, in fact, include House District 33, ably represented by the good chair of this committee. I am here today to urge your support for House Bill 4137. House Bill 4137 appropriates another $2.5 million to the existing loan forgiveness program targeted to students participating in qualified rural tracks at health provider training programs in Oregon. Now, what's the deal with this? The first and most foremost thing is that nationwide we're facing a huge shortage of healthcare providers, and in Oregon we're definitely facing that shortage, and it's particularly true in rural parts of our state. We do not have enough doctors, nurse practitioners, PAs, dentists, pharmacists, you name it, available to provide the primary care and some specialty care needs that our constituents, our fellow Oregonians, need across the state. A loan forgiveness program has real benefits, and this has been demonstrated in lots of states around the nation, and this legislature has supported this program twice already. When this program was piloted back in the 11-13 biennium with $525,000, and when it was expanded in the 13 session to a total of $1 million. We have done extraordinary work in this biennium, increasing funding to help healthcare providers afford to become healthcare providers in the primary care fields that we need them to do. We need to do more. Despite having appropriated $7.5 million for this biennium for a combination of loan forgiveness and loan repayment programs, that's insufficient. And the more we can do and the more healthcare programs we can bring online, the better off we're going to be. One of the things that really excites me about this program is that because of the requirement for a qualified rural scholars program, almost every major health professionals program has either already received qualification, received certification for its program, or, as Mr. Walls will tell you, is about to receive certification for a rural scholars program at their institution. This means that those programs are training students in the ways that we need them to be trained to make sure that they go back out to rural Oregon when they're ready to practice and provide the service to Oregonians we need. Now, not only is this important to ensure the aims of the healthcare transformation that we've been working on this legislature for decades, frankly, since the Oregon Health Plan started back in the late 1980s, also, this is a huge economic boon to the state. The latest report by the Institute for Healthcare Workforce, published in January of 2013, demonstrates that statewide, on average, every physician creates 12 direct jobs in his or her community, 12, and generates approximately $2 million in economic activity per year in his or her community. That's a non-trivial sum of money. Those are people getting living wage jobs, contributing to their communities, generating indirect jobs, and helping their community be healthier so that children go to school and learn better, they stay in school, adults are healthier, and they're better workers in the workplace. These things are critically important. The program's effective. We know it's going to be effective here just the way it has been in Kansas and Massachusetts and lots of other states that have done this kind of program. We don't yet know exactly how many students will take advantage of this program. We don't know that. You have a letter from Mr. Dumig from the Office of Rural Health that says, we're not sure. The next cycle of applications is coming in April for this program. We hope to have the new program in Lebanon up and running by then so that their students will be eligible. We think that's very important. But we don't want to have to turn away any qualified student. Any student in a relevant healthcare profession who wants to make the commitment to learn in a rural track and to commit to coming back to serve Oregon in our most needy areas, our most healthcare workforce deprived areas, should be given the opportunity to do that. It's in the state's best interest, and I urge your support for this bill. Thank you very much.
Representative Springer, my father said it was always difficult to follow an animal act. I'll let you follow him.
I'm not even touching that.
Wow.
Well, fortunately, my colleagues.
That was pretty dynamic testimony, we have to say. It was
Thank
in
you.
Recognition of that statement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Wow. So, I'm Representative Sherry Springer from House District 17. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Only one thing that I'll add to the good senator's testimony here that I want to throw in. She mentioned 12 direct jobs, oftentimes as a result of one primary care physician. However, in some of our rural counties, that can be as high as 40. Let me tell you, the value of a job in rural Oregon is, the value of one job is huge. The value of potentially 40 is a game changer in a community. It's a game changer. So a couple things I just want to add. I'm not going to talk specifically about what the bill does, because I think that's been captured very well. But what I want to talk about is just share a brief story. Years ago, I was my first full-time cop job was in Grant County, John Day. And I found out subsequently that you spent some time over there. And I remember back in the heyday, there were some choices, not a lot, but we didn't think it was great, but I got to tell you, we sure found out soon that it was pretty good, because there were no physicians. And I remember that somebody I was talking to, their wife or their sister or somebody was pregnant, and there are no OBGYNs over there. Their health care came from Ben, 2.5 hours. I remember the 12-year-old boy that fell and broke his leg. It was a serious break, but it wasn't life-altering. He was life-flighted out so he could have the appropriate care. Now, when we live in rural Oregon, we assume some level of risk, but I got to tell you, I've never lived anywhere where I assume the risk of no health care. And I find it absolutely ironic that you just spent an hour and a half on testimony, a lot of which was around Cover Oregon, and I don't know exactly what the original content of that conversation was, but I find it absolutely ironic.
Actually,
that
for the record, it was 40 minutes.
Oh, okay, I apologize. That amount of time, the amount of money the state has invested, whether you like it or not, and that's not where I'm going with this conversation, the amount of investment that's been made in ensuring all of Oregonians everywhere, yet we have places in our state that can't get a doctor. And for a mere $2.5 million additional dollars, we can fund upwards to 35 primary care physicians in this community. So one of the ways that we got docs in John Day was to hang a carrot, and the carrot was, we'll forgive your loan. And a lot of docs, no offense intended, showed up, got some loan forgiveness, and left. We had one show up, tried to make a go of it. We were all excited. Young guy, young family. He was going to come and be a part of our community, except he couldn't make a living. He just couldn't make a living. He came in, invested some dollars in some real estate, tried to refurbish some storefronts in a very small town that desperately needed it. We thought, this is exciting. He couldn't make it. Unfortunately or fortunately, a lot of the patients in rural Oregon are Medicare, Medicaid. He couldn't make it, and he couldn't pay off his loans and build the life for his family that he decided to build. So after struggling for several years, he left. We want people to come into our communities, and I'll be honest, I really don't want somebody, I'll take it if I need to, I don't want somebody that shows up just to get some money and do their 4 years and jet. And that's why I think that there is a very important element in this, rural track. So you can't just figure out where you can go, because I got to tell you, I took a job that way one time. They didn't forgive any student loan debt I had. I paid for school. But what they did do is entice me with something that I needed. I went, I got it, and I left. And that's what a lot of people do. But yet in this, we're talking about a rural, not underserved, rural health care track program. So a school that invests time and energy into molding these docs that are going to stay in these rural areas. And so I can't begin to tell you how important this is. We spend billions of dollars on health care. We spend billions of dollars on all sorts of stuff. And we're talking about $2.5 million to provide health care to rural Oregons after we've spent a ton of money on whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, OHP, Cover Oregon. I'm not going to get into that dialogue. We spent a ton of money there, but we're talking about $2.5 million today. I certainly hope that you can support this bill.
And if I may, could I just add two other points before questions, Mr. Chair? The first is this. Representative Springer alluded to 40 jobs. One of the points that I would make is this. There are a lot of other employers who are interested in setting up in rural Oregon. They know that there's workforce available out there. They know that there are people who are looking for good jobs. They can get land and buildings cheap. But if they don't have health care in their communities, they're not going to locate there. So it's not just about the direct jobs that the health care providers provide. It's about enabling other jobs to be created as well. I think that's really important. I want to tell you a really fast story. I had the privilege of knowing a young woman who was going through our combined four-year family medicine preventive medicine residency. She came from Kansas and had participated in their loan forgiveness program. She's now back in Kansas, went back there last summer at the end of her 4 years of program. And I've stayed very close with her. She actually helped me with my campaign a couple of years ago. She's interested in that. She's got certification in family medicine and preventive medicine. She's got an MPH as well as an MD. And she's in a town of 500 people in Kansas. She's bought a house. She's trying to go on the school board. She's looking at implementing public health programs around the county. She's completely invested in that community, and the only way she could have done that was through a loan forgiveness program. And those are the kind of people that we're looking for, people who come from those areas and who will go back to those areas and stay there. I'm so excited about this opportunity. Sorry. Cheers. Thank you for your patience.
No, thank you. It's a tough act to follow there, so I'll be very brief in my testimony. My name is David Walls. I'm the executive director with the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon. Really just want to go on the record on behalf of the osteopathic physicians in support of House Bill 4137. As Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned, this will be open to osteopathic medical students at Comp Northwest. They're working the finalizing out that rural track with the Oregon Office of Rural Health right now. And as you may know, osteopathic physicians, they have a strong history of serving in primary care fields. About 60% of DOs in Oregon right now serve in primary care. Unfortunately, the number of students choosing primary care has been going down over the last 4, 5, maybe 10 years. A big part of that is because of the tremendous amount of student debt that the students are facing when they graduate. So opportunities to lower that student debt when students are considering what area of the state they may want to practice, what specialty they may want to go in, can have a huge impact for those students. Students right now may be very interested in serving rural Oregon, and they really have to weigh that against their ability to pay off their student loan debt. So putting more money into this program can really provide a great opportunity for the students who do want to serve in rural Oregon, and that's what we feel this bill can do, and urge your support.
Thank you. Any questions, this panel? Yes.
Question, comment. I'm very supportive of this bill. But I think one of the things we need to grapple with in Oregon as we go through this healthcare reform issue, which, independent of the Affordable Care Act, we were going to do anyway, is the rural situation. We've been losing healthcare practitioners at all level in rural Oregon for a long time. And if anything, it might be accelerating. But part of the problem, I think you just hit on the head, and we have to find a companion piece. How do we subsidize people on the training end of primary care so that we can then relieve their loans but at a lower level? And we could make this amount of money spread out farther. But we can't get people to go into primary care when they're accepting the loan debt they are. And, they want to be a specialist with a much higher income, and so would I. But we're going to have to grapple with that. We have to do a professional job inventory on what we need and then start paying to deliver that need. Industry does it all the time. If you need more engineers, a lot of industries will pay money to train those engineers. That's what we're going to have to do as a state. We need more rural docs. We're going to have to pay for the training of rural docs. We may still have to relieve part of the loan, but that $2.5 million will go a lot farther if we don't have as much debt up front.
Mr. Hayes, can I ask you to join us, please?
Mr. Chair.
Last witness.
Yeah. Oh, if I could just respond very briefly.
Yes, and then Representative Conger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Thompson, your point is extremely well taken. And interestingly,
somebody just has to move.
Interestingly, in the 1970s, primary care physicians made approximately 70% of what subspecialty physicians made. It's more like 30-40% now, and it's not so much because primary care reimbursement and salaries haven't gone up in a reasonable way. It's because subspecialty ones have gone up dramatically. The implementation of the resource-based relative value scale in the early 90s, which we thought was going to change things, really didn't, and we value doing stuff more than thinking. And that's one of the reasons why you get reimbursed so much more to do as a family physician, I get reimbursed more to do a minor office procedure than to counsel someone on their high blood pressure and help them live a healthier life. So it's a much broader problem, and you're absolutely right. And
we have three more minutes.
Sorry.
A question. And
apologize. It's a huge problem.
Well, I have a whole bunch of questions, but I think you kind of touched on one of them, which is the broader issue of primary care and access and cost. And so I'll narrow my questions to two. One's for you, Mr. Chair, and the other is for the panel, I guess.
We're going to carry this over to Friday, and we'll have more time to talk. Maybe you can join us again on Friday in a work session.
This may require a follow-up. I don't know. Does anybody have a sense of what the average cost of just medical school is and about where the average student loan debt is for grads?
Yep.
Sure do.
I'd love to hear that. And then the process question is, this must have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means to figure out how to pay for it.
Yep.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, yes, I can answer roughly both of those questions for you. At OHSU, for in-state tuition, it's approximately $40,000 per year for 4 years. That's $160,000 right there. That's in-state tuition. It's high, but it's not dramatically higher than a lot of other medical schools around the country. Total average debt for someone graduating from medical school is between $250,000 and $300,000. Now, we have not proposed, nor have we structured this program or our loan repayment programs to be able to deal with all of that debt. That was never the intention of any of these programs. We always want people to have to pay for their own education. They make choices about how to get that. But we do think that when they're making a choice to serve the greater good and to choose a lower-paying specialty in a lower-paying part of the state where our need is greater, that that's an appropriate use of state dollars for the economic benefit that it generates in terms of cost savings. Thank you for the question.
OHSU's tuition is relatively high among state medical schools.
Right.
Mr. Hayes, you want to briefly, please?
For the record, Caleb Hayes here on behalf of the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific Northwest, the DAO School in Lebanon. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I don't want to follow these two. I wanted to run out of the room watching this dynamic duo, so I'm going to keep it real quick. First, to answer through the Chair Representative Congress question, at Comp Northwest, tuition is about $50,000 a year, 4 years, so pretty simple math.
Did you say 50?
Yeah, and we haven't graduated our first class yet, so I couldn't tell you what the debt load is going to be. Getting to my testimony that I'll make very brief, Comp Northwest is a school that's geared towards solving problems like the primary care shortage we have in rural Oregon. And, you know, when we first talked about establishing a rural track for this program, Dr. Eversano, who I work with at the school, said, well, this whole school is a rural track. You know, it's just a matter of how you define it. And, we've been working with the Office of Rural Health, and we're hitting their benchmarks. And we're hopefully by the start of next year, we'll have that rural track started up. But as evidence to what we do at the College of Osteopathic Medicine, the U.S. News and World Report has ranked Comp, the sister school in Pomona, California, which is located in downtown Pomona, in the L.A. area, 18th for producing primary care physicians in the entire country. When Comp Northwest graduates its first class, I think you can expect that number to be quite a bit higher. Because this is a school that's actually in a rural area where we will have established the official rural track, and I think you're going to be very impressed. I think these two did an excellent job, David Walls, at explaining this entire concept. So I'm going to stop here. Absolutely support the bill. Please move it on to Ways and Means.
Good. Brief word to finish.
Well, just a question. Thank you so much for bringing this forward. And I just wondered which actual professions are there, nurse practitioners, PAs, dental, mental health, who all is included?
I'm going to get it slightly wrong, but I know that physicians, both MD and DO, are included. But it goes into the existing primary care loan forgiveness program, which I am sure includes physicians, NPs, and PAs. I think includes dentists, but the dental school hasn't established a rural track yet. I don't know whether it includes expanded permit dental hygienists. I think it includes pharmacists, but don't includes pharmacists.
I think it does.
I'm not positive. Part of the problem, if you will, is that, and this kind of exemplifies why we have this other work group going on right now to look at all the incentive programs that we have for healthcare providers in the state, because they all cover different groups of healthcare providers. Mr. Walls is working with us on that, as are a bunch of other people, and it's a really complex problem. We have to tailor the use of state dollars to make sure that we're getting the state's needs met in an effective way. So we're really looking at the evidence around these tax credits, loan repayment, loan forgiveness. And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but I'll actually be seeing patients on Friday afternoon, so I won't be able to rejoin you. I'm going to go be one of those primary care doctors.
Mm-hmm. Good. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4137, announce it will be carried over for a work session on Friday. I hope that we'll be able to move it to wage.
Great. Mr. Chair,
yes.
All we're doing is increasing the amount. We passed this in 2010. If it's okay to work now,
right.
I'm for it.
They can find the money for it.
Matter of fact, it's on Ways and Means.
Do you want to work?
We could just work it around.
No, I need to check in with Ways and Means before I do this. Yeah.
However, I was thinking of voting against it because it was just going on and on, I will say that.
Okay, after
all right, but we'll get five anyway. We are adjourned.
Thank you.